This Week in Virology, the podcast about viruses, the kind that make you sick. This Week in Virology, episode number 111, recorded December 6th, 2010. Hi, everybody. I'm Vincent Racaniello, and it's time to talk about viruses. And once again, TWIV is on the road. And today, we are in Fort Myers, Florida, at the Florida Gulf Coast University, doing TWIV in front of an audience, which I believe is composed of some virology students, right? Anybody else besides virology students here? A couple of other stragglers who like to see what's going on. And we have a great crew to do TWIV today. Joining me here on my left is Rich Condit. Hey, Rich.
Hello, Vincent. I could say hi, fellas, but there's more going on than that today.
Yeah, Rich is in his home state. He's happy. To Rich's left is Andrea Leal. Is that right? Did I get it?
Yes, it is.
Andrea is a deputy director of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District and an entomologist.
Mm-hmm.
Get all that right?
Yes, you did.
Welcome to TWIV.
Thank you.
Andrea, great to come here. I should mention that Andrea and her colleagues have flown in from the Florida Keys on the backs of mosquitoes. No. They were flown in, I believe, by our next guest, Amy Sargent, who's down there, the chief pilot. Is that right?
Yes.
Welcome to TWIV.
Thank you.
How did you fly here, in a helicopter?
In the Islander.
An Islander. What is that?
It's a twin turbine aircraft.
Ah.
We have two turbine aircraft along with the helicopters.
Did you have a good flight?
Yes, we did.
Very nice. Good day for flying. And you guys flew in just to do TWIV, I understand, right? There's no other business for you to do here?
No, that's correct.
So that's a first for TWIV. Pretty good.
I grew up watching Sky King. Do they say, warm up the songbird, Amy? No?
No.
You're too young. Okay.
Rich, you always date yourself. Okay. Finally, our last guest from the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District is Ed Fussell, the director. Welcome to TWIV, Ed.
Thank you.
Now, what's a shorthand for the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District? Is something you guys use as a shorthand? No.
Would you repeat that, please?
Do you have a shorthand for the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District?
No.
Okay.
You got no vowels. You need vowels.
Yeah, otherwise we can't make a, what do you call when you reduce
Alan knows. Come on, Alan. You're the, we haven't introduced
him. Well, we haven't introduced Alan. He's sitting up there not knowing what to do. Our final guest is Skyping in today, and we have him on the wonderful screen. Alan Dove, a science writer from Western Massachusetts. Welcome, Alan.
Always a pleasure.
Alan, this is the first time we're actually seeing Alan. After 110 episodes of TWIV, we have never seen Alan's face during the show.
And this is right. Now, you saw my face way too much back when I was in your lab, Vince.
That's right. That's right. And that's why this will probably be the last time that we do this as well. So anyway, welcome. I hope everything is clear for you, Alan. We're here today to do a TWIV, and we thought we'd do a TWIV on dengue in Florida. As most of you probably know, not too long ago there was an outbreak of dengue in Florida, and we actually have reported on dengue a number of times on TWIV, but we thought we had the opportunity now to talk to the individuals that were involved in looking in mosquitoes and trying to control the mosquito populations right here in Florida where it happened. So this is a great opportunity. So I should mention to the audience, at any time, if you would like to ask a question, Professor Isern over here has a microphone, and if you raise your hand, she'll come over and give it to you. So TWIV is all about participation. As you know, we get lots of questions from the audience, so please
We should
that.
Also mention that Professor Isern, Sharon, is really responsible for getting this whole thing together.
That's right.
We met her at the the TWIV that we did at ASV, started chatting outside the meeting, and one thing led to another, and here we are.
So Professor Isern invited us to do this TWIV, and we thank you very much. And without you, of course, it wouldn't have happened. Thanks so much.
I wanted to thank you guys for coming down. Unfortunately, you did bring the cold weather with you, so but welcome to Florida Gulf Coast University. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you. Well, I brought the cold weather because where I'm from, it's really cold. This is not really cold down here, even where you are, Rich.
No, it's going to go below freezing again tonight, but still it's not cold.
So none of you know cold.
What's the weather out there in Massachusetts, Alan?
It's cold.
It's cold. Okay.
It'll be cold till May.
Well, it's your choice to live there, but that's another story. Now, before we talk about dengue, I wanted to mention this building. This is a brand new building. It's called Academic Building 7. It's a LEED certified platinum building. LEED means Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. That's a building certification system. And this is the highest certification you can get in a building, and it's the first in the state of Florida and maybe one of the first anywhere. And getting LEED certified is based on a number of criteria, including conservation of wildlife, habitat, and water, energy efficiency, conscientious material sourcing and disposal, air quality, and comfort. And I can tell you that these are very comfortable chairs, and if I were at a lecture in this room, it would be quite easy to fall asleep.
Don't you dare.
That is my criteria for comfort, and I can tell you I've spent 30 years at Columbia in lecture halls, and I've never fallen asleep once because the chairs are too uncomfortable. So outside this building is a solar panel field, which we saw while we're coming in, that powers this building. So it's an amazing building, and it's really cool to have TWIV here. So not only thank you for having us, but also for having TWIV in this room. So before we talk about dengue, I'm really fascinated. These are the first mosquito control guys I've ever met. And I'd really like to know, what is the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District?
What are we doing?
What is it in general? Describe it.
Mosquito control in the Florida Keys is one of the most important things that we have that supports tourism. Tourism is our main source of revenue in the Keys, and without mosquito control, air conditioning, airplanes, and maybe a couple of other things, there would be no Florida Keys that would be inhabited. There's a direct correlation between the development of the Keys and mosquito control.
Yeah, we watched your video on from your website the other night, and they pointed out that Florida was regarded as essentially uninhabitable because of the temperature and the mosquitoes in particular.
That's right. And the Keys is nothing but a great big breeding habitat for mosquitoes. And we're also completely within a National Marine Sanctuary, which makes our situation unique, because I'm not aware of any other mosquito control program that has to operate within such an environment. And a lot of our area that produced mosquitoes was in a wildlife refuge that's classified as wilderness area. And if you're anybody that's operated around a wilderness area, you know that you don't do anything in that area that is going to modify or change. You cannot operate mechanical equipment or motorized equipment.
So that increases the challenge for the mosquito control?
It definitely does. But and it's our responsibility to provide a means by which people that shouldn't be there, they are there, and they can live comfortably and make a living.
So who finances the whole thing?
We're an independent taxing district within the Florida Keys. We don't come under the county, which is Monroe County. We have our own district. We have our own elected board of commissioners, and we operate.
So you raise taxes locally to fund the whole operation?
We tax all the residents of Monroe County, which is essentially all of Monroe County that is inhabited is in the Florida Keys. Most of Monroe County is in the Everglades, and that's
That's really interesting, because when I first became aware of the Mosquito Control District, in particular in association with the dengue outbreak, I sort of assumed that it was a public health thing and would be funded in some broader fashion by some government agency. It never occurred to me that it was a tourism issue. That's very interesting.
Is there a control commission such as yours in every county or every region of Florida?
No. There are only 15 mosquito control programs that operate as independent taxing districts. There are about 50, around probably 55 or something like that, that operate that what we refer to as organized mosquito control programs. They operate under the state guidance, and they report their operations, the use of pesticides and that sort of thing to the state. And the rest, these are mostly in the coastal areas of the state. There are a few inland, but probably one of the larger ones that's inland would be Orange County, Orlando. But most of the mosquito control have organized programs are along the coastal mm-hmm. areas.
It's probably worth pointing out that many states have similar control programs as well, right? I know my home state of New Jersey has a mosquito control commission as well, and I'm sure many other states do.
There are other states. There are three states that have the highest level of organized mosquito control, mm-hmm. Florida, New Jersey, and California. Now, there are others that have a mosquito control, and on an individual basis, they are organized within their own unit. But Florida, California, and New Jersey. New Jersey is, I guess, the oldest program that was organized, but Florida was close behind.
There are many good things about New Jersey that people don't realize. But that's the topic of another show entirely. So is it safe to say that your activities fall into two areas, control and monitoring?
We probably have the highest degree of monitoring mm-hmm. of any program of which I'm aware. We base our control program as much as we can, and I would say probably three-quarters of it, on larvaciding. And the only way that you're going to be successful in larvaciding is have a high degree of monitoring. And just about exactly half of our employees are inspectors, field inspectors, domestic inspectors, that's where we put our emphasis.
How many employees are there?
We right now have about 85.
And roughly how many square miles does that take care of?
Well, in Monroe County, there are about 1,800 square miles. And we have access to about almost 100 square miles. We don't have any access to the Everglades, and we don't want it because we would use up all of our resources and still not be able to accomplish very much there.
So can you tell us in a little more detail how this works? Maybe Andrea and Amy can also weigh in. I'm interested how you do the control. Let's work with that first. Does it involve spraying, aerial spraying, or does it involve manual placement of larvicides?
Destruction.
What's that?
Habitat removal.
We really don't do any of that. As Director Fussell said, we're very environmentally conscious down there. When it comes to control, we have inspectors that go out basically to designated areas every single day and go out and see how many mosquitoes are actually biting them. It's called a landing rate count. So they'll stand in the field for about a minute and just count how many mosquitoes land on them. Also, we do a lot of different trapping, so we know mosquito numbers that way. The inspectors also go out.
Could you go do that again? People go out and stand there?
People go out and stand, yes, in the field on a daily basis and count how many mosquitoes land on them to bite them, yes.
How much do they get paid?
Not enough. You can ask them yourself. They'll say not enough. It depends on the time of year, I guess. This time of year, it's not too bad. In the summer, we've had landing rate counts of 50 to 100 mosquitoes on one person in a minute. So it can get pretty bad in the summer.
Wow.
How do you make sure they don't become ill from this activity?
Well, the mosquitoes that are biting them in the field are usually the salt marsh mosquito, mm-hmm. and we don't have any sort of history of them transmitting diseases down there.
Okay, so the goal of this program, a main goal is to make the region inhabitable, to make it pleasant, because otherwise people would be bitten and they couldn't do anything.
Right. And, you know, it is, a lot of people are allergic to mosquito bites as well. So it is a health issue when you get a large number of nuisance mosquitoes. So it's not just the disease transmission, mm-hmm. Which is also a possibility because we have historically had diseases in the Keys. But also that health issue if you're getting numerous bites.
Which, aside from dengue, what other vector-borne diseases are you worried about? In mosquitoes?
Historically, we've had yellow fever. Right. We've had malaria. We did have a couple cases of West Nile virus down there as well. Mm-hmm. But those are the main mosquito-borne diseases.
Not chikungunya.
Well, of course, that's always in the back of everybody's minds. But we're kind of hoping that stays overseas for quite a while.
And so Ed directs the whole operation. Specifically, what's your job?
I do whatever Ed tells me to do.
And that involves probably a little bit of everything, right?
We do resistance monitoring. We do trapping, identification of all the mosquitoes that we collect. That way we know what mosquitoes are biting and where they are. Just a little bit of everything.
By the
way, so now you get this monitoring information. What do you then do with it to reduce the mosquito population?
Well, depending upon what we find, if we get high numbers of mosquitoes in certain areas, we will aerially treat with insecticide. That's kind of a last resort for us. We do have fog trucks as well, which are insecticides. But the main thing we do is larvaciding, so we treat any mosquito larvae that we find in the water. And that is really...
And is there... Is there like a public education component of this too, or is that in a different department?
No, we do public education as well. We go out and teach in the schools. We have a biologist that goes to all of the festivals locally and has a booth set up with information. We do newspaper ads. We have a television show that we produce weekly that has mosquito information. That's a big component. What we really would like to do is to get homeowners really involved in mosquito control because, you know, even with the number of employees that we have, we can't be everywhere at once. So we'd really like to get homeowners involved a little bit more. It's a goal of ours.
And there's a website that describes your program that Vincent and I were looking at last night. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, but that has a nice little 10-minute video that we saw that was really nicely produced that really describes the whole program and has a significant public education component. Mm-hmm. That was really, really good.
Amy, do you do the aerial spraying? Are you involved in that?
Yes, I do both the adulticiding with the insecticide, and then I'll do the larviciding and the helicopters also.
So the larviciding is using a bacillus species, right? Which Bacillus thuringiensis, BTI,
believe. We use BTI, yeah. Yes.
And so that's dropped as pellets into the waters?
Yeah, we actually now, as of just this last week, we have two types of larvicide. We have a dry larvicide, the VectorVac G that we put out, and we have hoppers on the helicopters, and we fly over all the swamps and marshes and put out the dry pellet. We're usually about 50 to 75 feet when we're releasing these pellets. And then Saturday, we just flew our first mission with our liquid larviciding system. And that was for the dengue down in Key West. We sprayed Key West and did a liquid larvicide treatment.
So when you do this aerial spraying, is it usually just the pilot, or do you have other people on board to assist?
It depends. When we're doing the adulticiding, we just have the pilots, also the liquid larviciding. We just have one pilot. In the airplanes, we'll have two pilots if we're doing the adulticiding. When we're larviciding with the pellet, we have an inspector on board because that's a lot of spot treatments. So we need the inspector on board to show us, you know, yes, we need to treat this area today, but this one, you know, doesn't have any larvae.
So you must get really low in order to do this, right?
Well, yes.
Is that cool?
Yes, it's cool.
So what is the, what do you have for airplanes and helicopters?
We have two turbine islanders that we use for the adult siding, and those have Micronair systems. They're two pods. They look like bombs underneath the wings because it's a high wing aircraft.
You have two of these?
We have two of the islanders, okay. Yes. And then we also use it to go to meetings around the state. I get to fly them around, so that's kind
like,
of fun.
Like TWIV.
And then we also have four helicopters. We have two Bell Jet Rangers, Bell 206Bs, and then we have two Long Rangers.
And I have to do this. Where did you learn to fly?
I started in high school. Actually, they had an aviation program. So I was flying for the airlines after 9/11. I was furloughed and found a job at Mosquito Control in Florida Keys.
Have you always flown helicopters?
No, I was a fixed wing only, but then when the chief pilot position came open about 7 years ago, they said I had to be dual rated, so they Mosquito Control actually trained me.
Wow.
So Ed and Andrea, I'm curious as to how you ended up doing this. I know you were an entomologist by training, correct?
Yes.
So you went to school. So how, when you went to school, did you eventually envision a career in mosquito control, or did you have other things in mind?
No, not even close. I went to the University of Tampa, is where I got my undergraduate degree, and my goal was to work with coral reefs. But I was planning on moving down to the Florida Keys and just basically applied anywhere I could that had any sort of biology to go with it. And luckily, mosquito control had an opening, and I went to mosquito control, and I really never looked back. And through mosquito control is where I got my entomology training. I got my master's degree through the University of Nebraska. So, it really grew on me, and I really love the field.
So I know your boss is here, but do you love this job?
I do. Somebody plug his ears, but no, I do. I do really love my job.
Great. And Ed, I know you have a military background, right? How did you end up in mosquito control?
I have a bachelor's degree from University of Georgia in entomology, and I have a master's degree in epidemiology from Yale University, and I retired from the Navy as a medical entomologist and traveled throughout the Pacific primarily with a year in Vietnam, and most I was dealing with mosquito control.
One of our listeners some time ago wants to start a podcast on medical entomology. So something just like TWIV, except dealing with your field, the relationship between various vectors and infectious diseases. And I think that would be a terrific podcast.
I'd subscribe to that.
Yeah, I would too. Absolutely.
And of course, you guys all knew that ultimately, you would be on a virology podcast. Right?
that was always my goal.
As part of your screening, do you actually look for viruses in your specimens, or do you send them elsewhere to be checked?
Actually, that's where Florida Gulf Coast University comes into play. They have been testing all of our collected Aedes aegypti mosquitoes for dengue virus for us since this past June, I believe.
So you don't do it in your laboratories at all?
We do not. However, we are in the process of building a laboratory to do our own testing. So hopefully by next mosquito season, we'll be up and running.
Sounds pretty good. Any questions about careers before we move on? We'll start talking about dengue now. Be really curious to hear. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention this. For everyone who asks a question, I have a prize.
I have a question.
I can't hand this to you, Alan. But, Alan, it is one of our bumper stickers here. Actually, these are magnets. They say microbes, we need them. So I have 15 of them. They'll stick on your refrigerator. So if you ask a question, I'll give this to you anytime between now and the end of the show. I'd like you to ask questions, but I really want to get rid of these two. They're really heavy. I don't want to carry them with us. So, as you know, beginning in the end of 2009, there was an outbreak of dengue in the Keys. And we've talked about dengue a lot. Dengue, TWIV number 3 was an entire episode on dengue. And in fact, Rich and I listened to it in the car on the way down here.
Talk about nerdy, right? A couple of virologists on a road trip listening to themselves on the podcast in the car on the way down.
Well, we were learning, Rich. Yes, but there's no question about the nerd geek element here for sure. And then in 95, I believe, not too long ago, we talked about the outbreak here in the Keys. As you know, it began when an individual who had vacationed in the Keys went back to New York State, and she was diagnosed there with dengue fever, which was a really very perceptive diagnosis on the part of the clinicians, because she hadn't gone out of the country, so there, at the time there was no presumption of dengue, which, as you know, is a tropical disease, although expanding in numbers. It's the most common vector-borne viral disease that we know of at the time. Millions of infections globally, and many cases of hemorrhagic fever, death, as well as the less severe dengue syndrome. Eventually, that led to screening here in the Keys. And if you read the CDC report, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report had a wonderful article May 21st, 2010, where they went through these cases, and we described them on TWIV 95, so I won't go into them again. But they summarized the cases, and then there's a paragraph called Control Measures and Investigation in response to the 3 cases of locally acquired dengue. Those were 3 in the Keys. The Florida Keys Mosquito Control District increased the frequency of truck and spraying, et cetera. So that's what I'd like to talk about now. FKMCD, that's what you guys are, the FKMCD.
You need vowels.
Need some vowels, I know. So here's my first question. You found out about the dengue cases in New York and locally. What did you guys do? And who told you first about this? The Department of Health, I presume?
I believe that's where we got the information from, the Department of Health. Well, we have known for some time that we were very vulnerable to getting a dengue or, somebody mentioned a minute ago, chikungunya. I think it's on its way. And I know that they had a case in Miami recently that happened to be a case that included a dengue. It was a combination of dengue and chikungunya in one person. But it hasn't gotten to the Keys yet, but I'm confident it will. But we knew that we had to get busy and try to, at that point, we wanted to try to kill as many of the adult mosquitoes as possible to eliminate the transmission. And we discovered that killing Aedes aegypti is not an easy job in either the larval stage or the adult stage, and particularly in the adult stage, because their habits are different than the habits of the other mosquitoes that we normally control. The Aedes aegypti is active during the day, and the others are more active in the evenings or at night.
So what percentage of the mosquitoes in the mosquito population are aegypti?
What percent?
Yeah.
It depends on where you are. If you're in Key West, it would be about probably over half.
Okay.
With a Quincifas aedes being
the other. So it's a significant fraction.
Yeah. All right. And we do get some flights of salt marsh mosquitoes, the Aedes tenorincus, into Key West, but that's not our main problem down there.
And now, Aedes aegypti is also a container breeder, so it's not like you can just treat large areas of water and be done with it, right?
That's exactly right, and that's one of the things that makes it difficult. Aedes aegypti, it will breed in any kind of a container that will hold water, and these mosquitoes do not lay their eggs in water. They will lay their eggs in containers on the sides of the containers that when they fill with water, it'll flood the eggs, and then they will hatch almost immediately.
So rain gutters would be about ideal.
Rain gutters are very good places, and the rain gutters are almost inaccessible in most areas. So that's an area that they can breed in without being threatened. And they can also breed inside the home. and never have to go outside because they can hatch, emerge as adults, find their blood meal inside the home, have a place to lay their eggs, and they just keep doing cycles without ever going out. It only takes a very small amount of water. And we tried the typical method of controlling Aedes aegypti in the past has been eliminating the containers. If you can eliminate the containers, you should be able to eliminate the all of the habitat for the Aedes aegypti breed. We found that that was more of a job than we anticipated. And we wanted to reduce the what we call the incidence rate to like 2%, and that would mean that if you inspected 100 homes, you would only have a breeding in 2% of them. If you can keep it that low, then your likelihood of having a transmission of dengue is not very high. But we had as many as 35 or 40 inspectors out going door to door, emptying containers, talking to the residents, and trying to get their cooperation. And we'd show them what to do and tell them how to do it. And in hopes that when we left, that they would continue to do it. We'd go back in about a week and find the same thing there over again. And that continued time after time. We never were able to convince the public to get informed or get involved. And a lot of it, in our case, was due to the media. For some reason, the local papers did not get involved. The involvement by the papers, they lambasted mosquito control for trying to take advantage of that situation to boost our budget. And even a couple of our own commissioners in mosquito control and several of the elected officials around the city of Key West and Monroe County, they had some of the same sort of comments. Not one of any of the commissioners. We had three commissioners on our board that they were busy in trying to convince the people that this was a serious situation. All the rest of them, not one of them, had anything to say in support of mosquito control and try to convince the public that it was a serious situation and that they should, for their own health and well-being, participate.
So is this a obviously, this was August 11th, 2009, was the first case, and let me see, I don't know when exactly you got involved. September, you were doing surveys through September through December 2009, so it's a year back. What's the situation now?
We had
major epidemic, or what the outbreak is gone. There is this one new case in Miami. Mm-hmm. Are you still significantly concerned about dengue, and is the relationship with the media improved at all?
The answer to your last one is no.
Okay.
Are you
listening out there, media?
Yeah.
Okay. That's right. Alan, for those of you who don't know, is a science writer, okay? So
newspaper coverage in Key West. Unless there's a job available.
I think one of the biggest steps that we took to control this problem was the addition of more domestic inspectors. And these are the inspectors that go house to house. We added 4 more people in Key West itself. So right now we have 13 people that are on Key West trying to eliminate any containers, treat any containers that they might come across, and hopefully educate residents as they go. You know, as for the situation right now, Director Fussell was talking about the incidents, how we wanted to be around 2%. Well, Monday and Tuesday of last week, I looked at all of the inspections throughout all of Key West, and we were still at about 11% of all the homes. And this is November we're talking about. So still, we don't have the cooperation that we need to really control this.
So Aegypti is not the only dengue vector, right? There's Albopictus is a candidate as well. Is that right?
We don't have Albopictus in the Keys.
You don't?
No.
Okay, so that's not a problem.
We have a question up here in the audience.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were working with the schools at all down there to like educate the public. Do you have any collaboration with the schools?
Yes, we go to all of the schools throughout all of the Keys. I think there's three high schools down there, and then a number of elementary and middle schools. We have a biologist that goes to them full-time, basically, and talks to almost every single class, as well as participates in any sort of education days and truck days, that type of thing, just to let all the students know, and hopefully they would take that home to their parents. But yes, we do try to get the schools as involved as possible.
So do you still check mosquitoes for the presence of the virus? And if so, what as of today, is there any dengue in any of the mosquitoes?
Let's see, Dr. Isern, did she hear that question?
Could you repeat the question?
I'm wondering if there's dengue and mosquitoes today in Key West.
So we've been surveilling the mosquitoes that Key West has been sending us, frozen mosquitoes that we look for whether or not dengue is present. We've had so far 3 positive hits, not recently, but total positive hits, and they have all been the same serotype. There's 4 different types of dengue, so we keep finding one, which is the same as the human cases.
Which serotype is that?
Serotype 1.
Serotype 1.
Mm-hmm. So far just the one, but we haven't gotten anything in the most recent pools that we've looked at.
How do you assay the mosquitoes?
So actually we have one of our lab persons here. I don't know if she's there. It's Amanda Graham. So she basically takes the frozen mosquitoes and homogenizes them. And she's figured out that they're actually really hard to break apart. We had some mosquitoes grow in the lab that we were using to determine control conditions for how to homogenize, and it ended up that the ones from the Keys were pretty hardy, so we had to get a pretty hefty instrument to homogenize. Then she isolates the nucleic acids. She looks for the genome of the virus. It's an RNA genome, so she reverse transcribes it into DNA, and then using the right PCR primers amplifies different segments of dengue and looks to see if there are 1, 2, 3, or 4, and she can identify which type.
So now you're still getting positive mosquitoes relatively recently. That would imply that there have been more human cases of the disease, right?
Yes, we've gotten them probably within the last 10/27, so late October was the last time that we got a positive hit. But this is a surveillance effort, so you have to actually screen a lot of mosquitoes to find your positive hits, but it's still apparently in the mosquito population.
The last positive case, I believe the onset date was October 30th, so we haven't had any human confirmed cases after that one.
Okay, so maybe you guys are doing a really good job.
We got a question here. No, we need you on this to get them.
Oh, how many human cases have you found dengue in?
There have been 60 confirmed cases this year and 27 in 2009.
So we're all. I'm interested in the number. How many of these might be asymptomatic? Were all those symptomatic cases?
Those were all symptomatic and confirmed through the health department. Another thing to consider too, you know, the health department will only test people for free if they are the first 5 days of the illness. So someone comes to them 2 weeks after and they're already feeling better, the health department would send them to their physician, and it would be up to that person if they wanted to pay for the test or not. So you're missing a lot of cases that way. And again, like you said, 50% of people are asymptomatic. So the number of confirmed cases really is just the tip of the iceberg.
So if
now, can dengue transmit vertically in mosquitoes?
It has been shown.
Refresh my memory on that?
It has been shown to be transmitted that way. Yes, we haven't seen that in the Keys that we know of, but we really haven't been testing male mosquitoes or mosquito larvae, so we don't really know what's going on in the local population.
So by vertical transmission, we mean the females wind up laying eggs that have the virus in them, and so the larvae grow up with the virus and could transmit that further. Mm-hmm. Pretty clever little virus.
We have a question.
Well, it was already answered, but I'll still ask it anyways.
Yeah, you'll get a bumper sticker if you do.
I know you guys mainly focus on the mosquitoes, but why don't you look at the larvae?
Well, it's all a matter of, you know, we have only so much money in our budget, and we can only do so much. If we had unlimited funding, that would be a wonderful thing. But unfortunately, we kind of have to pick and choose what we can and can't focus on, and our main focus is just on the control of the mosquito itself.
So if we were to graph this event from the first dengue cases a year or so ago through time, there was a what we could call an outbreak, is that correct? Where there was, it came up and waned again, is that right? So where do we stand, and how do you see the future of this? Is this something that's going to, is this an incursion that's going to spread in the southern United States, in your opinion, or is this an outbreak that's going to peter out?
I think you're looking at two separate situations here. You're looking at what we think will happen in the Keys, and then what might happen, say, in Miami,
okay,
for example. And they may not be related.
Okay.
Now, one of the things that we have tried to do is concentrate our efforts, and we have been successful in that, and keeping the outbreak limited to a small area of Key West, down in the Old Town area. And the Old Town area of Key West probably is one of the most ideal breeding sites for Aedes aegypti that you'll find almost anywhere. It's just a lot of old homes with porches that are open for resting and whatnot for the mosquitoes. A lot of gutters and homes very close together. A lot of trees and vegetation. And it's just an ideal situation there for them. But we have more resources than Miami does. I mean, literally. And our budget is probably 5-6 times what Miami-Dade's is. And if they had an outbreak, it would be more likely to turn into an epidemic than it would in the Keys. Now, what we hope is going to happen, we just started here just very recently. I think we had our first runs on it in August, using a new product. It's still BTI, but it's in a different formulation, and it's a powdered form that you mix with water and apply it as a suspension. And we have been able to get the best coverage and kill of mosquito larvae that we have with anything that we have used so far. And we're doing it by aerial application, which gives us an opportunity to cover a lot of the area very quickly.
So that's even applicable in a situation like an Old Town in Key West?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, that's where we've been doing all of our testing.
So you can get the gutters that way, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So, Amy, do you use helicopters for that?
Yes. Yeah. We actually... we hired a company to come in and do it, and when we did our trials in August and September, to make sure that it was working and to get a look at their spray system. And then we just recently, in the last few months, that's what we've been working on, is putting this new spray system together and building it and putting it on the aircraft, along with a support truck, because you need to have the truck with the mixing tank and everything, mixing the water and the BTI. And then we had our first successful spray mission 2 days ago, Saturday. We sprayed in the morning.
So the initial cases, the index cases in this, these are people who had not traveled outside of Key West in the recent past. Where's this coming from? You know? Or any ideas?
Well, once we get our initial introduction, which could come from anywhere in the Caribbean, because dengue is scattered throughout the Caribbean, and it's essentially next door to us. And once that gets into Key West, and then that person becomes viremic, and when the mosquito bites the viremic person and picks up the virus and then starts spreading it to other people in the area, and it just spreads.
Basically, you're saying it's sufficiently established so we don't have to worry about where it came from anymore.
That's right. Here.
Okay.
That's right. And since probably less than half the people that are infected are symptomatic,
right,
then you never know.
Right.
So with polio, it's possible to track the spread of viruses. So we know, for example, the epidemic of polio in the Congo originated from Angola and before that from India. Can you do that with dengue? Probably this is a question for Sharon. Can you do sequences and track exactly where isolates came from?
Actually, not quite sure how to answer that question. I mean, you can certainly sequence the genome to try to track it. That's try to figure out where it's been introduced from. So whether it's coming, I guess, similarly from either the Caribbean, as Ed mentioned, or maybe coming from a traveler or from mosquitoes coming from Asia, it might be there might be ways of figuring out, looking at phylogenetic analysis.
So is there enough genetic drift in the virus so that you could do that kind of? We just did a TWIV last week about looking at a criminal
right, sequence drift in HIV.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sequence drift in HIV, allowing you to track transmission of the virus in criminal cases. And we're wondering then whether the sequence drift is sufficient so that you could track the migration, if you like, of the virus.
So far, the first sequence that was looked at was only a partial genome sequence. So it wasn't the full genome sequence, just the envelope. So it looks like it might be closer to Mexican.
Yeah, the health department did some work last year sequencing, and it was the 2007 Mexican strain. You know, whether that tells us anything, I'm not really sure, because I believe you can find that throughout the Caribbean as well.
Mm-hmm. And do we know anything about the Miami isolate in that sense, what the origin of that might have been?
I actually don't have any information on. I know it's a different serotype than what's been found in the Keys, but I don't know if the media has, if it's gotten out to which serotype it is. I just know that it's not dengue 1.
It's not dengue 1.
It is not. I believe it is 2. 4? Okay, 4. It's dengue 4.
Dengue 4.
Great. So this is, not great. So this is, for those who are not tuned into this is significant because, as we've said before, there's two forms of dengue. One is when you get infected the first time, can be usually a fairly mild disease, dengue fever. But if you get infected by one serotype and then a second serotype, you can get a more serious disease, dengue hemorrhagic fever, and that's a bummer. So when you have two serotypes circulating, you got a bigger problem. Now, does it matter which two serotypes it is? We were talking about this.
No, just as long as it's a different one than the initial one from which the person got a response against. And so then you can get increased, worsened or enhanced disease symptoms the second time around.
Okay, so the notion that the Miami case is not the same serotype as what was in Key West is a big red flag.
Probably not a good thing, because that means that we have two circulating strains, right. And so it's very possible that an individual can be infected with mosquitoes that have the different two strains that have been found.
There is also
and it also implies that this is likely to happen again. I mean, if we got back-to-back two different serotypes in Key West and Miami, then where's the next one going to be, and what's it going to be?
Correct.
There was also a locally acquired case in Broward that was a different serotype than those two as well. It was serotype 3.
So now we have 3.
Okay. Sounds like Miami mosquito control needs more money. Did you have a question?
I'm sure they're accepting.
We have a question here.
So dengue is normally a tropical disease, but how far north can Aedes aegypti breed and transmit dengue?
Southeastern U.S. Is primarily the area that we'd be concerned with. And just how far up that'll go, I would say probably up to Virginia, maybe something like that.
And we had mentioned Aedes albopictus also can transmit the disease, and that goes all the way up the entire eastern seaboard. So really, it could happen anywhere.
Now, we've had two cases of hemorrhagic fever this year. The first case we had this year was a hemorrhagic fever. And then later on, we had another. And so far as we can determine, both cases had been exposed earlier to one of the other serotypes.
Sharon, can you get hemorrhagic fever from just one serotype, or does it really take two?
As far as I understand, it seems like it takes the second one is where you start getting those symptoms. Okay. I'm not absolutely sure. So,
right.
Yeah, it was just especially with children that have had the antibodies from the mom, and so they have already an existing antibody in their system, and then they get infected for the first time with dengue, but now it could be the second hit.
So the presence of hemorrhagic fever is basically clinical verification of circulation of two strains, two serotypes.
We have a question here.
Yeah, you a little bit earlier were talking about where does this dengue come from in Key West. Have you done any looking at any seroconversion rates of the resident population? And so what did you find, and what do you think that means?
The health department and CDC were involved in a sero survey of the population in 2009. And what they did is they did a mile radius around the index case location and found that about 5% of the residents had recent infections with dengue virus. There hasn't been any sort of sero survey outside of that area. So I can't really tell you for all of Key West what it is, but just that area that we already knew the virus was circulating in.
That was 5% of the residents?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty big number.
It is, yes.
So do you have any sense I assume that in response to the identification of dengue cases in Key West, you intensified your operations, mosquito control operations. Do you have any way of knowing whether that was effective at limiting virus propagation?
Well, we would like to think that it at least limited the spread of it, but it wasn't nearly as effective as we had hoped it would be. And I think that if we're putting a lot of our hope on this new larvaciding program with the new formulation of BTI. Otherwise, I think that it would have eventually spread up the Keys. There's much movement of people up and down the Keys, and from the Keys to Miami, from Miami down the Keys and whatnot, that it's a wonder that it hasn't already spread into Miami.
What's the advantage of the liquid form of the larvicide relative to the pellet form? Because they're the same bug, right?
Yeah. The main difference, and last year I wanted to use the granular form. We use hundreds of thousands of pounds of the granules each year for our salt marsh mosquitoes, and I wanted to use that. But we started running into resistance right away because people don't want the granules in their pools. And there are a lot of open-air restaurants in Key West, and people don't want the granules falling into their food as they're dining outdoors. So that sort of ruled that out. And then there was a liquid formulation that is used, I think, primarily by the Forest Service that spotted cars very badly, and it was difficult to clean off. So that was a problem, and it was only recently. I think that this product has had some limited use overseas. I believe they've tried it in Australia in some tests. But to give you an idea of the sales of it, the largest container that it was available in was a one-pound container. And so it was only when we got that, and you mix it with the water, and we apply it. The first applications were 3/4 pound mixed with 1/2 gallon of water to an acre. And then the operation we did on Saturday, we dropped it down to 1/2 pound and 1/2 gallon of water to an acre. And we got the same results, killing the larvae, as we got with the 3/4. So we know that we can probably come down even more.
So it's pretty efficient.
Yes, very efficient. And one of the advantages of this product over the granular material is this seems to leave a residual that may be good for up to maybe 10 days or 2 weeks. And that is a real advantage there. If it is deposited on leaves and on foliage, then when water evaporates, then the powder is left there on the leaf. When it rains, then it's washed off into any containers that might be underneath that. And when we apply it by air, it gets in the gutters, too, and that takes care of that problem. And also, just flat rooftops are a problem for mosquito breeding.
So my sense is that a large fraction of the population are basically germaphobes, and they figure any bacterium is bad.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So do you get flack from the population because you're spraying bacteria all over their town? Or do they just know it as an insecticide?
Well, you always have a few people that will call and be mad about anything that you're doing. Anybody in mosquito control can tell you that you definitely cannot please everybody. But I think that the majority of the population understands the importance and supports us.
Okay.
Well, just tell them it's not the bacteria. It's a toxin that you're spraying. That'll make them feel bad.
Well, that's true.
Yes.
Yeah, I had a question while I'm surrounded by all these experts in the room. I did quite a lot of research on dengue because my daughter, who lives in St. Thomas, contracted dengue fever in September, and she was very, very ill. And when she was well enough to fly, she did fly home, and I nursed her back to health. She's still recovering. But my question is, which I did not find in my research, but that's internet research, so you know how that goes, Googling this and that, is that you talked about that she, now that she has the virus, she carries it, she can carry it to her unborn child, and that would, if the child ever had contracted dengue, it would be, you're saying maybe the hemorrhagic dengue, and if she gets it again, it could be hemorrhagic if she got another type, or if she got the same strain. So, yeah, I just wanted to hear about that. Thank you.
So she's not going to pass on the virus itself. What she's going to pass on are her maternal antibodies. So the antibodies, so if she breastfeeds or just right after birth, she gives the maternal antibodies to her infant. If that infant then gets exposed to dengue, then if it happens to be the same serotype, then there's not a problem. The baby would be protected, but if it's a second serotype, it may lead to enhanced symptoms, so the other things that we talked about. So it's only if it's a second serotype. Now, again, she's not going to pass the virus, just her own immune response against the virus, as if she had had a vaccine against dengue. So it's the same principle as vaccine, you just have the antibody response.
But those maternal antibodies wane over time, right?
They will
so
wane
only
over time.
A window in time when that's going to
right, so as long as she's breastfeeding, that will continue, and then they will eventually wane over time.
And just so to finalize this, they love St. Thomas. The only reason they are moving home next summer when she's through with her teaching this her commitment this year, but is because of dengue fever. There, it's really epidemic in the Virgin Islands, and it's pretty scary.
Tell her not to move to Miami.
Okay,
there's a right there. Sure.
I just had a couple of questions. The BTI, does it only basically destroy the larvae, or does it also affect the mature mosquitoes?
Only the larvae. And it has to be consumed by the larvae. And we only have about 48 hours, maybe 72 in some cases, to once we find the larvae, to get the material out there before they go into their fourth instar, which is their last stage of development as a larva, and they stop eating and then go into their pupal stage. What happens, and it's a very specific product for mosquitoes, the bacteria will release a toxin. And that's what kills the mosquito larvae. But the toxin is only released at a very specific pH. And that pH is found in a mosquito gut. And the same pH is not found so far as we know, in anything except, say, mosquitoes, midges, black flies, and maybe one or two other species.
Where did this bacterium originally come from? Was it a natural mosquito pathogen or an insect pathogen? The bacterium.
The bacteria, it's just a naturally occurring bacteria that is found throughout the world. And this particular strain was found in Israel, and that's where the I comes from on the
So was it initially isolated from mosquitoes or some other insect?
It's a soil bacteria.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Do you see the mosquitoes becoming resistant to any of your insecticides?
We have actually observed resistance starting to some of our insecticides that we use. That's why we do resistance monitoring the way that we do and try to rotate our chemicals as much as possible. The only resistance we've seen has been in the adulticide chemicals. There, we have not observed any resistance in the larvicides that we use.
Yeah, BT resistance turns out, this is something that's been looked at a lot in the biotech industry because it's the same toxin that's used in transgenic plants, like transgenic corn that's insecticidal. And it can occur under laboratory conditions, but it's been very, very rare in the field, apparently. It's just not an easy thing to evolve resistance to.
Yeah, in a recent issue of Science, they talked about releasing a genetically modified, sterilized male mosquito. I was wondering what your thoughts are on that.
We have a test scheduled for this coming May on that. We've been working very closely with the developer of this product. As a matter of fact, we have a teleconference tomorrow with them on it. It's developed in the UK, and we think that we if we can get the population of the Aedes aegypti down to a certain level, which would be a very low level, at just what it would be number wise. I don't think anybody knows, but let's say that we could end up with maybe 5% of the numbers that we currently have now in the wild. Then release these genetically modified adults, and you would release them as adult males, that when they mate with a wild female, that female only mates once. So that ends her productive life. The offspring from that union, they will all die. Both males and females will die. Now, they had it so that only the females would die, but then they were able to manipulate that and have it so that they both male and female offspring would die. So you keep releasing the manipulated males, and they keep mating with the wild females, and pretty soon, theoretically, they're no more.
If you think
this approach, except for the transgenic part, this approach has actually been used in the past, the sterile insect technique, and has been successful in eradicating, at least locally eradicating, some insects.
I think probably the most significant use of that was a screwworm fly in the southeast. And for a fraction of the cost of the eradication, the savings was many times that each year after that.
Yeah, Alan knows a bit about that screwworm story, right?
Yeah, my Ed Nippling, who directed that research, was a colleague of my grandfather's at the USDA. So I was very familiar with that story.
That's good. We had that question on our agenda, so thanks. And, you know, if you think you have trouble with the press now, wait till you start releasing mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, this company, Oxitec, is the company you're dealing with, I assume. They're the same ones who have been in a little bit of hot water about the release they just did on the caimans, which was somewhat poorly publicized.
Right.
Well, they did it on the sly, I think. That was the problem.
Well, there's debate about whether it was done on the sly. According to the company, they announced it in advance, but according to some folks who saw the PR materials, they announced that they were doing the sterile insect release, but they didn't explain that these were transgenic sterile insects, which shouldn't make a huge difference, but in the public mind, it does.
Well, some of them are afraid that if we eliminate a species of mosquito, that's going to have an impact on the ecology, and it's going to upset the food chain. And
how do you respond to that? I mean, because you know something about insect ecology. Is that hold water, that argument?
Well, my general response is that we, in all the mosquito control efforts that have been done, we have never eradicated a single species of mosquito.
So eradication is unlikely anyway.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Kevin, it's control.
Question up there.
I was wondering if the BTI has any adverse effect on people, like if they're immunocompromised or in large amounts, because I know as a kid we used to think it was fun to chase the fog truck with our bikes.
Well, as far as BTI goes, there are no effects on humans. I don't know what was in those fog trucks you were chasing, but that might be another story.
How are you feeling? You feeling okay?
So we actually posed a theoretical question some time ago on Twitter, but we didn't have any experts. Now that we have mosquito experts, here's a theoretical question. If you could wipe out all the mosquitoes in the world, and I know you can't, but let's say you could, would anybody care? Would it have any effect on the ecosystem?
I would care because I'd be out of a job.
Okay.
No, I'm sure that some people would look at it as being a very unsound thing to do because of the organisms and other insects that to feed on mosquito larvae. And the dragonfly is probably the best example of a good predatory insect, in my opinion, because the larvae of the dragonfly feed on mosquito larvae, and the adult of the dragonfly feeds on mosquito adults. So that's I don't know.
So it sounds like it's not unlikely that it would introduce some imbalance, okay, because they are part of the ecosystem.
Yeah, there's always an adjustment in the biological life of if they lose one source of food, they'll go to another, and if one habitat is disturbed, they'll go to another. They will adjust to it, just like people adjust.
So you're saying if we run out of oil, we'll find something else?
Maybe solar panels out there.
Well, and you can make this argument with campaigns that have successfully eradicated an insect from an area, like the screwworm fly. There probably were adjustments in the ecosystem in response to that, but I don't recall the world ending.
That's right.
My question just had to do with, you spoke a little bit about chikungunya virus and a possible upcoming outbreak about that and a strong worry for that. I know that also it utilizing the Aedes mosquito as a primary vector, what do you believe is a cause for a possibility of an uprise of this of an outbreak of this virus? And do you think it has any effect, do you think that global climate change has any effect on this upcoming outbreak that you may perceive to become?
I don't know, there's probably people here that know more about global change of warming and whatnot than I do, but it's difficult to predict. They talk about the rising of the oceans and flooding areas. That may happen, but I would guess that in the case of mosquitoes, they'd probably head for higher ground. Everything would be relative. Then the high ground now would be low ground then, and they would adjust. Insects are probably one of the most adaptive things there is to changes in the environment.
Yes?
So have any other methods of biocontrol been considered, like releasing predatory arthropods to control the adult mosquitoes?
No, we haven't done any sort of control for adults when it comes to biologicals. However, we do use mosquito fish, gambusia, quite often. And that's mainly our source of biological control are those fish, because they do live very well basically in any container you put them. We put them in drains. We put them in cisterns, which are large areas that hold water under the old homes. We put them pretty much anywhere and haven't had a problem. They do a great job.
Any other questions from the audience? Anything from you, Rich, before
yeah,
we move on?
I'm cool.
All right, let's move on to a few emails. I've chosen a few here at the outset that might interest the mosquito control group. And the first is from Scott. He writes, I am based in Hong Kong, and there has been a local outbreak of dengue among the international community here. This is the first local transmission of dengue in 7 years. Several students at my children's school have taken off of school with apparent dengue symptoms, such as rash and muscle pain. So there you go, another part of the world where there is an outbreak. Is Hong Kong one of the places where you would expect to find outbreaks of dengue?
I wouldn't be at all surprised. Dengue is pretty much limited to tropical, subtropical right. areas, and I don't know. Hong Kong is not, in my opinion. I've been there a couple of times, and I don't recall seeing very many palm trees and things of that sort there. But. I really don't have any idea what the population of Aedes aegypti or Aedes albopictus might be there.
Well, they do. There's an article here in a which he sent us a link to in the Manila website, and he said most of the cases, 43 cases in 2009, were all classified as imported into Hong Kong. So they're coming from areas where dengue is endemic, I presume. So there's probably not endemic transmission.
Well, we've seen an increase, especially this year, in dengue throughout the world, case number-wise. Mm-hmm. Here in Florida, we've had 123 imported cases of dengue, you know, to go with the 62 locally acquired.
Right.
So we've really seen a rise in dengue all over the place.
Why do you think that's happening?
Your guess is as good as ours. You know, international travel, I don't know if, you know, weather-wise, what it was like, if it was, you know, more rain this year, higher temperatures, and it was more
conducive for dengue. Are we monitoring more closely?
What was that?
Monitoring.
Are we?
Yeah, absolutely.
Dick Depommier says that with increased population, there are more opportunities for containers to be filled with water. People discard their food containers, or they spread into areas where they haven't lived before and make more standing water, basically. So that's probably a part of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at this as kind of a man-made issue. It's our containers that are out in the yards. If there weren't containers, they do still, mosquitoes breed in tree holes and the bromeliads that fill with water. But really, the majority of what you see is something that someone's discarded or just hasn't taken care of in their own yard. So it really comes back on the population themselves as to if they really want to take it seriously or not.
He ends up by writing, after listening to TWIV number 3, that's the TWIV dengue episode, I feel much more informed about dengue. Even though you are now in the 100s, it would be great if you could continue to occasionally produce educational podcasts. I really appreciate these episodes. So that's from Scott from Hong Kong. Peter is from Germany, and he writes, gentlemen, I thought this might be interesting for you since chikungunya was at least glanced a few times in TWIV. Sadly, though, the blog post itself is in German. So he sent the link to a blog post in a German paper talking about the spread of chikungunya in Germany, which chikungunya, which we've talked about, has spread globally since the virus changed to be able to grow in Aedes albopictus, which has a global range, of course. It's spreading its way through Europe. He says, it seems that many factors are at work here. Travelers brought Aedes albopictus to southern Europe. The chikungunya virus successfully adapted to that new host. climate change opens up new habitats for the insect. This should be an interesting progress to watch. So he sent a few links, which we'll put in the show notes. Before I found TWIV, that is, before TWIV number one, I didn't know much about virology. Yes, I knew that it's an interesting field, but accessible knowledge wasn't widely accessible for a layman like me. Now, not only do I know about the virus, I also know about the vector and can watch it get closer to where I live. I haven't seen Aedes albopictus here, close to Frankfurt in Germany, but according to the maps, it's creeping up the Rhine Valley, which is no surprise since the upper Rhine Valley is the warmest part of the country. It's going to be interesting to see how the distribution will change in the next 10 or so years. Thanks for the education you provide. There's so much in it, from the beautiful intricacy of the biochemical interaction between virus and host to the real-life implications of an insect carrying it to new parts of the world. So thanks, Peter from Germany. And as we've mentioned before, chikungunya is on the move. And Ed thinks it's only a matter of time before it comes to the U.S. Certainly the mosquito is widespread. You mentioned before that there's no albopictus in the Keys, right?
Right.
Do we understand that?
Well, they have gotten into the Keys at different times, but in isolated spots. Mm-hmm. And when this happens, we go in there and just literally knock the heck out of them, and we eliminate that foci there. And we've done that about maybe a half a dozen times in the last 10, 12 years.
Is their breeding behavior different? Do they lay eggs in the water? Or is...
No, they're very similar to Aedes aegypti. Okay.
So the control measures are similar.
Tires are the main thing. They seem to prefer tires as a place, and that's the way they got into this country, through tires that were being brought back for reconditioning from Japan. But they will also breed in places like tree holes. They have a little wider area and will travel a little further from the homes and whatnot around the area. And I have heard from one of the entomologists with CDC that they had observed an aerial spray application for adults. And they were able to get good control of albopictus adults by aerial spraying, which is greatly different than you would get with Aedes aegypti.
Our next email is from Jim, who writes, I found your podcast several weeks ago on iTunes. I really enjoy it. I learned to love science, biology, and more specifically immunology back in the late 70s and early 80s. I had a very heavy dose of microbiology because in those days, immunology was a part of the microbiology departments where I studied. Anyway, your podcast reminds me of that time and my abiding respect for those who can do science. I was too impatient. I loved the ideas of science, but not the doing of science. The book that got me interested in science was titled The Eighth Day of Creation. I am on podcast number 8 or 9 and look forward to many interesting hours ahead. I did skip ahead and listen to your last podcast yesterday and was pleased to hear that you had discussed retroviruses in one of your previous podcasts. I do not know whether it is appropriate to describe retroviruses as way cool, but the idea of them certainly is to me. My coworkers think I am a bit nuts when I start telling them about the polio vaccine and why there was an outbreak recently in Africa, as you guys predicted. And also, congratulations in predicting the avian virus would not be the cause of the next flu pandemic, but that more likely H1N1 would be the cause. Thanks a lot for your work and your contributors. So speaking of H1N1, you mentioned the problems that you have, the Mosquito Control Division, with the press and them appreciating what you're doing and saying that you just want to get more money. That's why you make a big deal of it. It's the same thing with the flu vaccine manufacturers. Many of the public say they're just they're trying to make money by pushing this flu vaccine, which we really don't need. And of course, that is not true at all. So many aspects of infectious diseases have the same problems. And I think it's because they're not understood. And that's why we do this in the end. Our next email is from Alfred, who is a physician in the emergency department in Camden, New Jersey. Not far from me. Alfred writes, a bit behind on my listening, but the question came up a few episodes back why an endogenous retrovirus does not seem to become active and replicate. So many animals in their genomes have endogenous retroviruses which do not replicate. They are just copied along with the genome, but they don't make infectious viruses. My question would be the opposite. Is there any advantage to the virus becoming active again? If the goal of viral infection is to propagate its genome, then what better way to do it than to incorporate it into the genome of a successfully reproducing organism? Once the genome is in the germ cell line, each time the organism reproduces, the genome is reproduced. Any activation of the genome in that organism is going to lead to an infection in the organism. This will force the organism to divert resources to support the growth of the virus and to the development of an immune response to the viremia. Both of these may decrease the organism's chances of successful reproduction and decrease further passage of the virus's genetic material. I can think of two instances that might justify activation of the virus. One, if having the endogenous retroviral genome leads to a mild infection, then activation and communication of the virus might weaken competitors without the endogenous virus and give the organism with the ERV a reproductive advantage. Two, if the ERV has some type of monitor to recognize when an organism is dying or stressed beyond reproductive capacity, the virus would benefit by becoming active again and transmitting its genome to other organisms through more traditional means. I know of some trees that only go to seed when the tree is stressed, but I'm sure there are other examples of infectious processes that bail out when their hosts no longer appear viable. You guys are still the best podcast on the web. Keep up the great work.
Boy, he's heavy into it.
Yeah.
He is. For those of you who haven't listened to TWIB much, Alfred is an ER physician, and he's seen some cases of rabies in the ER. And we've had an ongoing dialogue with him about that. It's a very rare disease to see in most parts of the U.S., and it's not easy to pick up. And as he's told us before, usually when people come to the ER and they present with rabies symptoms, we just think they're on drugs and we send them home. But it's very difficult to diagnose. So these are very good points. I mean, an endogenous retrovirus has an advantage because it's reproduced along with the genome. So that's all it needs, right? It doesn't have to make particles. And there are many examples of endogenous retroviruses that do that. But as he said, if they're activated, it would kill the host. But then there are many endogenous retroviruses that have evolved for many, many years in the host. And even when they replicate, they don't cause disease. So, for example, there are many mouse endogenous retroviruses that replicate and don't cause any disease in the animal. So the different ways that viruses coexist with hosts are highly varied. And what I've learned in the end is just no one way that's successful. Whatever way works for the particular virus-host combination, that's the one that persists. The next one is from Ken. He writes, "Your netcast is one of the highest quality science netcasts available and my favorite. I was wondering if you have any advice for people in science who would like to follow in your footsteps. Netcasts are an amazing tool for education, both to an expert audience and the general public. However, I have noticed that there is a distinct lack of health-related netcasts that are both evidence-based and accessible to non-experts. Several popular health netcasts are dedicated to naturalistic or homeopathic medicine, complete with stores selling their cures and a general disregard for science. Scientists and physicians need to use this form of media to provide a rational voice that is friendly to lay people and covers pertinent topics. I will likely be attending medical school next year and was thinking of starting a netcast and interviewing available experts. Thoughts or suggestions?" And then he adds that he was going to interview at Columbia in late October, and any chance I could meet either of you. But of course, since we read the email so late, it's too late to meet him because October is well gone.
Wonder if he got in.
Well,
I don't know.
Yes, my suggestion would be you're probably not going to have much time, at least in the first 2 years of medical school, so you might want to put off the netcast a little while.
I totally agree. I think he's not, he probably doesn't realize how much time it's going to take in medical school. It's a great idea. As you know, Alan, at PNS, the medical students put on musicals, right? They have a theater troupe and they find time to do that. So maybe he can find an hour or two a month to do a net cast.
Yeah, but it's different. I mean, a musical they'll put on, it's a couple of rehearsals, and then they do the show. A net cast, it's a, every week you've got to be at it, whether you've got a final exam or not. So,
although if he could sit down every few weeks and just record his thoughts about medical school on his own, that could be interesting.
Could be.
Useful to future medical
conversations students. With his fellow medical students.
Or yeah. That too, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's useful. But the idea of getting into experts, you have to prepare, and it takes time. I think it's a great idea, and he's absolutely right that we need more of these, but I think he should wait, because you do want to become a physician. Otherwise, your parents will get upset if you flunk out of medical school. Okay, one more email. This is from Judy. Hi, guys. Nice to have the three of you back together again. I guess this is when Dixon came back a long time ago.
Yeah, but there's four.
Yeah. Well,
okay. We're way behind on our email.
You were discussing textbooks. I think we had a discussion about textbook becoming electronic at some point. A pet peeve of mine, I am a high school science teacher in California. Our textbooks are large, expensive, poorly written doorstops that don't even really follow the California state standards. So if the publishers are kowtowing to us in California, I feel really sorry for teachers in the smaller states. But there is an interesting change coming, the Common Core Standards, and she provides a link for this organization. The state governors started this movement, supported by ideas of change with the Obama presidency. 40 states have ratified that they will adopt and use the Common Core Standards, unifying what information students should get in K-12 education. Once kids are all to be taught the same thing, publishers will put money into online and virtual texts and classes. It is moving that way now, but to have digital texts and online classes, kids need to have iPads or netbooks. Right now, the only thing we can spend textbook money on is books, physical paper books. So laws will have to change to bring education into the 21st century. I was listening to NPR and National Public Radio Freakonomics radio podcast, I think, and I heard the following. If we went back in time 100 years, we would recognize very little except the classroom with one teacher and 30 kids. Like here, right? Scary. I have hope we will apply all the things we know now about how the brain learns and the conditions we need for learning to occur. Thanks for all I learned from you and all the bad puns. That's
you're quite welcome.
Yes. So, that's your cue, Alan.
That's great. I mean, she's right. Things are really, in terms of teaching, are still at a point where they were 100 years ago. And now we have so much that we can do, it doesn't seem to percolate down. We were just talking in the car driving down here today how we can do this netcast because of technology. If we didn't have the internet, if we didn't have Skype, we couldn't do it. It would be very difficult. So it's enabled by technology, and I think you need to take advantage of that. And that's what we're trying to do to push learning forward. And schools have to do the same thing, but it's very difficult. I think we were talking about electronic books on iPads, but yep. there are significant barriers. Okay, let's do a few science picks of the week. Let's start with you, Rich Condit.
Okay, so my pick is a book that was actually used in one of our courses for first-year students. It was sort of an orientation course. It's a Cold Spring Harbor publication called At the Bench, A Laboratory Navigator, Updated Edition by Kathy Barker. Actually, it occurs to me that this might be particularly appropriate for this audience, for anybody who might be going to graduate school or whatever. So this is... No, when I went to graduate school, they just kind of threw me in and said, okay, figure it out. And this is written by a person who was frustrated with that experience and would have liked to have some sort of formal orientation. So it's a book about all of the basics in getting oriented in a laboratory, just to read some from the table of contents. General lab organization procedures, laboratory setup and equipment, getting started and staying organized, how to set up an experiment, laboratory notebooks, presenting yourself and your data, making buffers and reagents, storage and disposal, working without contamination, eukaryotic cell culture, bacteria, DNA, RNA, protein, radioactivity, centrifugation. Man, what a great chapter. I love centrifuges. Electrophoresis microscopy, okay? So it's all the basics, including, like, be nice to your colleagues, right?
Why are you looking at me?
When you run out of something, order it, right?
That's right.
That kind of stuff.
Which never happens. I don't think a book's not going to teach people to do that.
Oh, I don't know. Read the book. Everybody's going to do it. Okay? So at any rate, that's my pick.
There's a review here on Amazon. I wish I had this information when I was a student.
I wish I had this information when I was a student. It sounds great.
You were my student.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, you forget. You had all the information you needed.
Yes.
Just kidding. Alan, what have you got for us?
Mine is I'm a sucker for beautiful images of nature, and this is the apparently the fourth annual running of this photo contest. It's the organization is called Deep Indonesia. It's an underwater photo competition, and if you go online, you check out this site, the images are just absolutely stunning. They're from all over the world. It's not specifically Indonesia. So just really, really cool images, all taken underwater, mostly by scuba divers. And I don't know. I find this sort of stuff really cool.
They are very pretty. They're really nice. We're looking at the first three, gold, silver, and bronze here. What on earth is that? Looks like some sort of squiddy thing.
Yeah.
The yellow one, yeah.
Yeah. We should have set this up so we could project it, but...
It's an eel.
Blue ribbon eel.
It's a blue ribbon eel.
All right.
Very cool.
All right. Well, my pick is something sort of related to what Rich picked. This is a resource from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and they have many resources for people who want to learn science. We've picked some of them before. This one is called Resources for the Development of Early Career Scientists. So these are all free guides. They're available as PDFs. A practical guide to scientific management for postdocs and new faculty, training scientists to make the right moves, and resources for scientific management training. So this is all in the line of what you've picked, except they're free. They're at the HHMI website. And you might find these useful if you're just starting out. Old guys like Rich and I, well, we couldn't change anyway.
So I'll tell you, though, because this makes a lot of sense. This goes beyond, I think, the laboratory manual, because you go to graduate school, you get your PhD, you go do a postdoc, okay? And then all of a sudden they throw you in a laboratory and they say, okay, set up the lab, get a grant, administer the grant, teach a course, do all that stuff. And you haven't been trained to do any of that stuff. And deal with all the people that come into your laboratory. I was going to use a different word. All the people that come into your laboratory, you know, whining or upset or don't want to work or whatever. And you're not trained to do any of that stuff. So a little guidance would be helpful.
By the way, there is a Rich Condit lab guide, and it's on TWIV. And if you look hard, you will find it, and it is really funny. That's all I'm going to tell you. But you said we could post it, so okay. It's up
yep.
there. So there are many ways you can listen to TWIV. By the way, any more questions before we wrap up this show? I got a couple of bumper stickers left. Those of you who did ask questions, come down afterwards. I'll give them to you. Well, that's great. We had some nice questions. One more? Okay. Well, while you're walking over there, we have a Facebook fan page, facebook.com/thisweekinvirology, all one word. You can go there and check out what we're up to. We're taking videos and pictures on this road trip. We'll put them there, and you can interact with us in other ways as well. There are many ways to listen to TWIV. You can go to iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, and if you do, please subscribe and leave a comment on iTunes if you haven't done so already. It helps us stay on the front page of the Medical Podcast Directory, which we've been on for many, many months now. It's really great. You can also listen on your smartphone, either an iPod, iPhone, iPad-type device, or an Android device with the Microbe World app. You can check that out at microbeworld.org. And you can also go to twiv.tv and listen or download the episodes and check out our show notes. Yes, you have a question.
Yes. Earlier you said that there was a case of a mixture of dengue and chikungunya virus. Is there only one case of that, or have there been multiple cases found?
That was Ed, right? You'd mentioned...
What's the question?
The case where there was a mixture of dengue and chikungunya. Has there been more than one case found?
I'm only aware of one case.
Okay.
I don't think there was any local transmission of that. That person, I believe, was a resident of Miami and had been to India for about a month on vacation.
Another question.
Those bumper stickers are big draws.
Going back to the careers, how is the current field of virology and entomology, or is it just like a long, dark road that you have to really love?
You want to start with entomology?
Well, I kind of just fell into mine, luckily. I know that you here in the state of Florida that there have been quite a few openings with different mosquito control districts, so that's always an option to consider.
Ed, you've had a long career in medical entomology. If someone wanted to go into the field now, does it look good or bad for them?
Well, I don't know. To be quite honest with you, it depends on the individual as to what you're inclined to do. And I know when I was during my junior year, when I thought I was getting into my major, I was going into education. And then I had a job during the summer doing a cotton insect survey, and decided on that, went back, and I had already taken a basic course in entomology during my junior year. But during my senior year, I changed my major to entomology. And then went into the Navy shortly thereafter as an entomologist, and spent my entire time there in the Medical Service Corps as a medical entomologist. I tried extension work for a year after I got out of college, and I either had to join the military or they were going to draft me. So I decided to join, and got into a field that I wanted to get into, and I stayed with it and liked it, and I thought that what I was in offered a lot of opportunities for what I wanted to do. And there are a variety of things that will lead you in one direction or another, and I don't think that you had to start collecting insects while you were still in diapers to want to be an entomologist. I think you can decide that at a much later time in life. But I think that a lot of us, maybe most of us, we end up in a particular field because of circumstances rather than a lifelong ambition. But I think it's a great field. I'm very satisfied with what I did and what I've been able to accomplish. And I think that I've been down in the Keys now 13 years working in this mosquito control program. And I think that's probably the most rewarding of any of my experiences, because I can see immediate results. And then having toward the end of my career before I retire, having this challenge to come along to really bring out everything that I've learned throughout the years about mosquito control. And I, one of the things I learned is that some of the things I learned didn't do me much good. And this, it was taking a situation and analyzing it and trying to solve it. And I think that we have been quite successful in doing that. And that's is one of the things that gives you greater satisfaction, I think, than just about anything else. And realizing the ramifications of finding a way to control Aedes aegypti, and it should work the same for Aedes albopictus, and possibly eliminate or greatly reduce, at the very least, diseases like dengue. And then, of course, the chikungunya that's been mentioned, that's another disease. Seems like all of the really great diseases that we have originated in Africa. Yellow fever, dengue, chikungunya, and they're all very serious diseases. And if you can find a way to reduce the occurrence of those diseases and the impact it has on any particular population, I think that is a great reward for a life's endeavor.
Well, virology is vibrant, and I'm sure Rich will agree. It's a great field. There's always something to do. There's plenty of places to be trained, and there's plenty to do. And with the technology we have now, you can do anything.
Viruses aren't going away anytime soon.
No.
And by the way, everybody begins collecting viruses when they're still in diapers.
That's right. That's right. Even before, maybe. And the thing is, it's cool to find out why they make you sick, but there are a lot that don't and probably we need. And so that's going to be really interesting to sort out. So I think a career in virology is not for everyone, but if you...
And I think one of the things you're hearing here from Ed and others is that, you know, do what you love. And if you love it, you're going to do well in some way or another. And, you know, don't restrict yourself too much. Take whatever comes along and just and do what you love to do, and it'll work out great.
Alan, you want to say goodbye to us now? You have to go?
Yes, I actually do have to go, but
right.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alan. Alan is at alandove.com. Thanks for joining us. See
you. Thank you.
See you, Alan.
Bye.
We have a question up here. Yes.
What made you want to start TWIV, and what do you hope to accomplish with TWIV in the future?
Nice closing question, huh? Go for it, Vincent.
So I started listening to podcasts a few years ago in my car. I have a very long commute, and I love them. I thought they were a great way to listen to what I wanted to listen to. And I heard someone say on a podcast that anyone can do a podcast. The technology is available to anyone. You can, and anyone can listen, and the cost is very low. But the most important thing is, if you're passionate about something, you can do a podcast about it. And I am passionate about virology. So I said, I can do this, and I can teach the world virology. So that's why I started it. And Dixon Depommier and I got going. Then Alan Dove and Rich Condit joined in. And now, in a given day, about 1,000 downloads occur of different TWIV episodes. And that's more, in a week, that's more people than I've taught in my entire career. So we can teach thousands and thousands of people about viruses, which I think is really important. And I would like to expand this to include other microbes. We now have This Week in Parasitism. In January, we're starting a This Week in Microbiology. I'd like to make it live, video, interactive, so we could have questions along the way. So I have lots of plans to build this. And I think in different fields, scientists who enjoy teaching can use the same technology. So I can act as a sort of mentor for them as well. So that's the short version of why we did this. Anything else? All right. And, of course, everyone else can always send us their questions and comments to twiv@twiv.tv. Rich Condit, thank you for being here. Thanks for driving me today.
Great. I look forward. This has been really good.
Terrific.
This has been terrific.
And you know what? I made a short version of your website, so now we can say it. You have this long URL for the University of Florida. bit.ly/poxdoc.
Far out.
bit.ly/poxdoc.
So if I do that, I can find myself?
You can find yourself online. So Rich Condit, of course, is at the University of Florida, home of the Gators, who had a lousy season this year.
They're still the fighting Gators. They're just losing.
I didn't fight very well this year. bit.ly/poxdoc. Thanks so much. And all the bug guys and gals from Key West. Ed, thank you so much for coming down.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. Amy, thanks for flying them. And yourself.
You're welcome.
Thanks for being here. And Andrea, thank you as well. It was great having you. And made it a really special TWIV. You can find them at keysmosquito.org. Keysmosquito.org. And thanks to our great audience. We really appreciate it. And huge thanks to Professor Sharon Isern for asking us not only to come here, but to do all the work to make it possible. You can't imagine what she had to do. So thanks very much.
Thanks for coming down.
Our pleasure. I'm Vincent Racaniello, and I'm at virology.ws. You have been listening to This Week in Virology. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week. Another TWIV is viral. Thank you.